The following program is a production of Sight Into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the seventh reading of Camino Island by John Grisham. I'm Rosina Chevalier. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. Mercer enjoys the dinner party and the other authors. She finds Bruce charming and his wife lovely. Denny is trying to track down the manuscripts and has killed someone to get the name of a bookseller, who then gives him Bruce Cable's name. Bruce is now in possession of the manuscripts. Now we continue with Camino Island. Noel placed a porcelain tea service on the table and deftly poured boiling water into matching cups. Both added a cube of sugar, but no milk, and as they stirred, Noel asked, "Do you talk about your work?" "I ask because most writers talk too much about what they've written or want to write, but a few find it difficult for some reason. I prefer not to, especially about what I'm doing now. My first novel feels old and dated, like I wrote it many years ago. In many ways, it's a curse to get published so young. Expectations are high. The pressure is on. The literary world is waiting for some great body of work. Then a few years pass and there's no book. The promising star is slowly forgotten. After October Rain, my first agent advised me to hurry up and publish my second novel. She said that since the critics loved my first one, they would certainly hate my second, whatever it was. So go ahead and get the sophomore jinx over with." Probably good advice, but the problem was I didn't have a second novel. "I guess I'm still searching." "Searching for what?" "A story." "Most writers say the people come first. Once they are on stage, they somehow find a plot. Not you?" "Not yet." "What inspired October Rain?" "When I was in college, I read a story about a missing child, one who was never found, and what it did to the family. It was an incredibly sad, haunting story, but also beautiful in many ways. I couldn't forget about it, so I borrowed the story, fictionalized it thoroughly, and wrote the novel in less than a year. That seems hard to believe now, working that fast. Back then, I looked forward to every morning, to the first cup of coffee and the next page. It's not happening now." "I'm sure it will. You're in the perfect place to do nothing but write." "We'll see. Frankly, Noel, I need to sell some books. I don't want to teach and I don't want to find a job. I've even thought about writing under a pen name and cranking out mysteries or something that might sell." "There's nothing wrong with that. Sell some books, and then you can write whatever you want." "The plan is slowly taking shape." "Have you thought about talking to Bruce?" "No, why would I? He knows the business and the art from every angle. He reads everything, knows hundreds of writers and agents and editors, and they often come to him for his insights, not necessarily his advice. He won't give any unless he's asked. He likes you, and he admires your work, and he would probably say something helpful." Mercer shrugged as if the idea might have merit. The front door opened, and Noel said, "Excuse me, but I have a customer." She left the table and disappeared. For a few moments, Mercer sipped her tea and felt like a fraud. She wasn't there to shop for furniture or chat about writing or pretend to be another lonely, troubled author trying to make friends. No, She was there snooping for any scrap of information she could hand over to Elaine, who might one day use it against Noel and Bruce. A sharp pain hit deep in her bowels as a wave of nausea swept over her. She endured it, waited for it to pass, then stood and steadied herself. She walked to the front of the store, where Noel was helping a customer who appeared to be serious about a dresser. "I need to be going," Mercer said. "Of course," Noel said, almost in a whisper. "Bruce and I would love to have you over for dinner soon." "How lovely. I'm free for the rest of the summer. I'll call." Later in the afternoon, Noel was arranging a collection of small ceramic urns when a well-dressed couple in their 40s entered the store. Her first glance told her they were far more affluent than the average tourists who dropped in from the street, browsed long enough to understand the prices, then hustled away empty-handed. They introduced themselves as Luke and Carol Massey from Houston and said they were staying at the Ritz for a few days, their first visit to the island. They had heard about the store, had even seen its website, and were immediately attracted to a tile-top dining table that was 100 years old, and at that moment the most expensive item in the store. Luke asked for a tape measure, and Noel handed one over. They measured the table from all directions, mumbling between themselves that it would be perfect in the guest house dining room. Luke rolled up his sleeves, and Carol asked if they could take photos. "Of course," Noel said. They measured two dressers and two large armoires, and in doing so asked intelligent questions about the wood, the finishes, the histories. They were building a new home in Houston and wanted it to look and feel like a provincial farmhouse, one they had vacationed in the year before near the village of Roussillon in the Vaucluse. The longer they stayed, the more enamored they became with virtually everything Noel had to offer. She took them upstairs to the pricier furniture, and their interest intensified. After an hour in the store at almost 5 p.m., Noel opened a bottle of champagne and poured 3 glasses. While Luke was measuring a leather chaise and Carol was snapping photos, Noel excused herself to go downstairs and check on the front. When the two stragglers left, she locked the door and returned to the wealthy Texans. They gathered around an old comptoir and got down to business. Luke asked questions about shipping and storage. Their new home was at least 6 months away from completion, and they were using a warehouse to gather furniture and furnishings. Noel assured them that she shipped all over the country, and that was no problem. Carol clicked off the items she wanted to purchase at that moment, one of which was the writer's table. Noel said no, she was holding it for someone else, but she could easily find another one during her upcoming trip to Provence. They walked downstairs to her office, where she poured more champagne and began working on a bill. The total was $160,000, a figure that didn't faze them. Haggling over prices was part of the business, but the Masseys had no interest in it. Luke laid down a black credit card as if dealing in pocket change, and Carol signed the order. At the front door, they hugged her like old friends and said they might be back tomorrow. When they were gone, Noel tried to remember a sale of that magnitude. She could not. At 10:05 the following morning, Luke and Carol breezed back into the store with bright smiles and high energy. They said they'd spent half the night looking at photos and mentally moving pieces around their unfinished home, and, well, They wanted more. Their architect had emailed them scaled drawings of the first two levels, and they had sketched in designs and placements of where they wanted Noelle's furniture. She couldn't help but notice that the house covered 19,000 square feet. They went to her second floor, spent the entire morning measuring beds, tables, chairs, and armoires, and in doing so, wiped out her inventory. The bill for the second day was over $300,000, and again, Luke whipped out the black credit card. For lunch, Noelle locked the store and took them to a popular bistro around the corner. While they ate, her lawyer checked the validity of the credit card and learned that the Masseys could buy whatever they wanted. He also dug into their backgrounds but found little. Why did it matter? If the black card worked, who cared where the money came from? Over lunch, Carol asked Noelle, "When will you get more inventory?" Noelle laughed and said, "Well, obviously sooner rather than later. I was planning a trip to France in early August, but now that I have nothing to sell, I need to move it up." Carol glanced at Luke, who seemed a bit sheepish for some reason. He said, "Just curious, we are wondering if perhaps we could meet you over there and shop together." Carol added, "We love Provence, and it would be a blast hunting for antiques with someone like you." Luke said, "We don't have kids and love to travel, especially to France, and we're really into these antiques. We're even looking for a new designer who could help with the flooring and wallpaper." Noelle said, "Well, I happen to know everyone in the business. When would you want to go?" The Masseys looked at each other as if trying to recall their busy schedules. Luke said, "We're in London on business in 2 weeks. We could meet you in Provence after that." "Is that too soon?" Carol asked. Noelle thought for a second and said, "I can make it work. I go several times a year and even have an apartment in Avignon." "Awesome," Carol said with great excitement. "It will be an adventure. I can just see our home filled with stuff that we find ourselves in Provence." Luke raised a wine glass and said, "Here's to antiques hunting in the south of France." 2 days later, the first truck was loaded with most of Noelle's inventory. It left Camino Island bound for a warehouse in Houston, where a large space was waiting. 1,000 square feet had been leased to Luke and Carol Massey. The bill, though, would eventually cross the desk of Elaine Shelby. In several months, when the project was over, for better or for worse, the lovely antiques would slowly re-enter the market. At dusk, Mercer went to the beach, turned south, and drifted along the water's edge. The Nelsons, from 4 doors to the south, stopped her for a quick chat as their mutt sniffed her ankles. They were in their 70s and held hands as they walked the beach. They were friendly to the point of being nosy and had already extracted the reason for Mercer's little vacation. "Happy riding," Mr. Nelson said as they left her. A few minutes later, she was stopped by Mrs. Alderman from 8 doors to the north, who was walking her twin poodles and always seemed desperate for human contact. Mercer wasn't desperate, but she was enjoying the neighborhood. Almost to the pier, she left the water and approached a boardwalk. Elaine was back in town and wanted to meet. She was waiting on the small patio outside the triplex she had leased for the operation. Mercer had been there once before and seen no one but Elaine. If there were others involved in the surveillance, or if someone was shadowing her, she was unaware of it. Elaine had been vague when quizzed about it. They stepped into the kitchen and Elaine asked, "Would you like something to drink?" "Water is fine." "Have you had dinner?" "No." "Well, we can order a pizza," sushi or Chinese takeout. What will it be? I'm really not hungry. Neither am I. Let's sit here, Elaine said, pointing to a small breakfast table between the kitchen and the den. She opened the fridge and removed two bottles of water. Mercer took a seat and looked around. Are you staying here? She asked. Yes, for two nights. Elaine sat across from her. Alone? Yes, there's no one else on the island as of today. We come and go. Mercer almost asked about the we part, but let it pass. Elaine said, So, you've seen Noelle's store? Mercer nodded. Her nightly report by email was deliberately vague. Tell me about it. Describe the layout. Mercer walked her through each display room, upstairs and down, adding as much detail as possible. Elaine listened carefully, but did not take notes. It was obvious she knew a lot about the store. Is there a basement? Elaine asked. Yes, she mentioned it in passing, said she had a workshop down there, but had no interest in showing it to me. She's holding the writer's table. We tried to buy it, but she said it's not for sale. At some point soon, you're going to buy it, but perhaps you'll want it painted. Perhaps she'll do this in the basement, and maybe you'll want to take a look to see a sample of the new color. We have to have a look in the basement because it adjoins the bookstores. Who tried to buy it? We, us, the good guys, Mercer. You're not alone. Why is this not comforting? You're not being watched. We come and go, as I've said. Okay, suppose I get into her basement. Then what? Look, observe, take it all in. If we're lucky, there might be a door that leads to the bookstore. I doubt that. I doubt it too, but we need to know. Is the wall concrete, brick, wood? We might need to go through it one day or night. What about the store's video surveillance? Two cameras, one aimed at the front door, the other in the back above the small kitchen area. There could be more, but I didn't see any. None on the second floor. I'm sure you already know this. Yes, but in this business, we triple-check everything, and we never stop gathering information. How is the front door locked? Deadbolt, with a key, nothing fancy. Did you see a rear door? No, but I didn't go all the way to the rear. I think there are some more rooms back there. To the east is the bookstore. To the west is a realtor's office. Any door connecting to it? None that I saw. Nice work. You've been here 3 weeks, Mercer, and you've done a superb job of blending in and not arousing suspicion. You've met the right people, seen all you can see, and were very pleased. But we need to make something happen. I'm sure you have something up your sleeve. Indeed. Elaine walked to the sofa, picked up three books, and placed them in the center of the table. Here's the story. Tessa left Memphis in 1985 and moved here for good. As we know, her will left her estate to her three children in equal shares. It had a provision leaving you $20,000 in cash for college. She had six other grandchildren, Connie, Holstead's bunch out in California, and Jane's only child, Sarah. You were the only one who got a specific bequest. I was the only one she really loved. Right. So our new story goes something like this. After she died, you and Connie were going through her personal items, the small stuff that's not mentioned in the will, and the two of you decided to divide it. A few items of clothing, some old photos, maybe some inexpensive art, whatever. Create the fiction you want. In the deal, you received a box of books, most of them kids' books Tessa had bought for you over the years. At the bottom, though, were these three books, all first editions, from the public library in Memphis, all checked out by Tessa in 1985. When Tessa moved to the beach, she either intentionally or inadvertently brought these three books with her. 30 years later, you have them. Are they valuable? Yes and no. Look at the one on top. Mercer picked it up. The Convict by James Lee Burke. It appeared to be in perfect condition, its dust jacket pristine and encased in mylar. Mercer opened it, turned to the copyright page, and saw the words, First Edition. Elaine said, as you probably know, this was a collection of Burke's short stories that got a lot of attention in 1985. The critics loved it, and it sold well. What's it worth? We bought this one last week for $5,000. The first printing was small, and there aren't many of these left in circulation. On the back of the dust jacket, you'll see a barcode. That's what the Memphis Library was using in 1985, so the book is virtually unmarked. Of course, we added the barcode, and I'm sure Cable will know someone in the business who can remove it. It's not that difficult. $5,000, Mercer repeated as if she were holding a gold brick. Yes, and from a reputable dealer. The plan is for you to mention this book to Cable. Tell him its story, but don't show him the book, at least initially. You're not sure what to do. The book was obviously taken by Tessa, and she had no legitimate claim to it. Then it was taken by you outside her estate, so you have no legitimate claim to it. The book belongs to the library in Memphis, but after 30 years, who really cares? And of course, you need the money. We're making Tessa a thief? It's fiction, Mercer. I'm not sure I want to defame my deceased grandmother. Deceased is the key word. Tessa's been dead for 11 years, and she didn't steal anything. The fiction you tell Cable will be heard by him only. Mercer slowly picked up the second book, Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, published by Random House, 1985, a first edition, with a shiny dust jacket. What's this one worth? She asked. We paid $4,000 a couple of weeks ago. Mercer laid it down and picked up the third one, Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry, published by Simon and Schuster, also in 1985. The book had obviously been passed around, though the dust jacket was pristine. That one is a little different, Elaine said. Simon and Schuster was anticipating big numbers, and the first printing was around $40,000. So there are a lot of first editions in the hands of collectors, which obviously suppresses the value. We paid $500, then put a new dust jacket on it to double the value. The dust jacket is a forgery? Mercer asked. Yes, happens all the time in the trade, at least among the crooks. A perfectly forged dust jacket can greatly increase the value. We found a good forger. Mercer once again caught the we angle and marveled at the size of the operation. She laid the book down and gulped some water. Is the plan for me to eventually sell these to Cable? If so, I don't like the idea of selling fake stuff. The plan, Mercer, is for you to use these books as a means to get closer to Cable. Start off by merely talking about the books. You're not sure what to do with them. It's morally wrong to sell them because they don't really belong to you. Eventually, show him one or two and see how he reacts. Maybe he'll show you his collection in the basement or the vault or whatever he has down there. Who knows where the conversation will go? What we need, Mercer, is for you to get inside his world. He might jump at the chance to buy The Convict or Blood Meridian, or he may already have them in his collection. If we have him pegged correctly, he'll probably like the idea that the books are not exactly legitimate and want to buy them. Let's see how honest he is with you. We know what the books are worth. Will he give you a lowball offer? Who knows? The money is not important. The crucial aspect here is to become a small part in his shady business. I'm not sure I like this. It's harmless, Mercer, and it's all fiction. These books were legitimately purchased by us. If he buys them, we get our money back. If he resells them, he gets his money back. There's nothing wrong or unethical about the plan. Okay, but I'm not sure I can play along and be believable. Come on, Mercer. You live in a world of fiction. Create some more. The fiction is not going too well these days. I'm sorry to hear that. Mercer shrugged and took a sip of water. She stared at the books as her mind raced through various scenarios. Finally, she asked, "What can go wrong?" I suppose Cable could contact the library in Memphis and snoop around, but it's a big system and he'd get nowhere. 30 years have gone by and everything has changed. They lose about 1,000 books a year to folks who simply don't return them, and, being a typical library, they have no real interest in tracking them down. Plus, Tessa checked out a lot of books. We went to the library every week. The story holds together. He'll have no way of knowing the truth. Mercer picked up Lonesome Dove and asked, "What if he spots this forged dust jacket?" "I've thought about that, and we're not sure we'll use it. Last week we showed it to a couple of old dealers, guys who've seen it all, and neither spotted the forgery. But you're right. It could be a risk we decide not to take. Start with the first two, but make him wait. Drag it out as you struggle with what's right and fair. It's a moral dilemma for you, and let's see what kind of advice he gives." Mercer left with the books in a canvas bag and returned to the beach. The ocean was still and at low tide. A full moon lightened the sand. As she walked, she heard voices that slowly grew louder. To her left and halfway to the dunes, she saw two young lovers frolicking on a beach towel, their whispered words punctuated by sighs and groans of erotic pleasure. She almost stopped to watch until it was over, until the final heave and thrust, but she managed to move on, absorbing it all as much as possible as she ambled along. She was consumed with envy. How long had it been? The second new novel came to an abrupt end after only 5,000 words and 3 chapters, because by then Mercer was already tired of her characters and bored with her plot. Frustrated, depressed, even a bit angry with herself and the entire process, she put on a bikini, the skimpiest one in her growing collection, and went to the beach. It was only 10 a.m., but she had learned to avoid the midday sun. From noon until around 5, it was simply too hot to be outside, whether in the water or not. Her skin was now tanned enough, and she worried about too much exposure. 10 o'clock was also about the time that the jogger came by, a stranger about her age. He ran barefoot at the edge of the water, his tall, lean frame glistening with sweat. He was obviously an athlete, with a seriously flat stomach and perfect biceps and calves. He ran with an easy, fluid grace, and, she told herself, he seemed to slow just a little as she came into view. They had made eye contact on at least 2 occasions the previous week, and Mercer was convinced they were ready for the first hello. She arranged her umbrella and folding chair and covered herself with sunblock, watching all movements to the south as she did so. He always came from the south, from the direction of the Ritz and the fancy condos. She unfolded her beach towel and stretched herself in the sun. She put on her sunglasses and straw hat and waited. As always on weekdays, the beach was practically deserted. Her plan was to see him in the distance and walk casually to the water, timing her movements to coincide with his. She would nail him with a casual good morning, the same as everyone else on this friendliest of beaches. She rested on her elbows, and as she waited, she tried not to think of herself as just another failed writer. The 5,000 words she'd just deleted was the worst junk she'd ever written. He had been there for at least 10 days, too long for a hotel stay. Perhaps he was renting a condo for a month. She had no idea what to write next. He was always alone, but too far away for her to check on a wedding band. After 5 years of lame characters and clunky prose and ideas so bad she didn't even like them, she was convinced she would never again finish a novel. Her phone rang, and Bruce began with, "Hope I'm not interrupting the genius at work." "Not at all," she said. "In fact, I'm lying on the beach practically nude, scheming to seduce a stranger." "I'm taking a break," she said. "Good. Look, we have a signing this afternoon, and I'm a bit worried about the crowd. It's an unknown guy with a first novel that's not very good." "What does he look like? How old is he? Straight or gay?" But she said, "So this is how you sell books. You rally your writers to come to your rescue." "You bet. And Noel is doing a last-minute dinner party at the house, in his honor, of course. Just us, you, him, Myra, and Lee. Should be fun. What do you say?" "Let me check my calendar. Yes, I'm free. What time?" 6:00, dinner to follow." "Casual attire?" "Are you kidding? You're at the beach. Anything goes. Even shoes are optional." By 11:00, the sun was baking the sand and the breeze had moved elsewhere. Evidently, it was too hot for jogging. The writer's name was Randall Zielinski, and a quick look online revealed little. His brief bio was deliberately vague and intended to give the impression that his career in dark espionage had given him rare insights into all manner of terrorism and cybercrime. His novel was about a futuristic showdown between the U.S., Russia, and China. Its two-paragraph summary was sensationalized to the point of being ridiculous, and Mercer found it even to be boring. His doctored photo was of a white male in his early 40s, no mention of a wife or family. He lived in Michigan, where, of course, he was at work on a new novel. His would be the third signing Mercer had attended at Bay Books. The first two had brought back painful memories of her aborted book tour 7 years earlier, and she had vowed to avoid the rest, or at least try to. Doing so, though, might be difficult. The signings gave her good reason to hang around the store, something she needed to do, and something Elaine strongly suggested. And it would be next to impossible to tell Bruce she was too busy to support touring authors, especially when he called her with a personal invitation. Myra had been right. The store had a loyal following, and Bruce Cable could organize a crowd. There were about 40 of the faithful milling around upstairs near the cafe when Mercer arrived. For the event, tables and shelves were shoved back to make an open space where chairs were packed haphazardly around a small podium. At 6:00, the crowd filled the seats and chatted away. Most were drinking cheap wine from plastic cups, and everyone seemed relaxed and happy to be there. Myra and Lee assumed their seats in the front row, just inches from the podium, as if the best seats were always reserved for them. Myra was laughing and cackling and talking to at least three people at once. Lee sat quietly beside her, chuckling when appropriate. Mercer stood to the side and leaned on a shelf, as if she really didn't belong. The crowd was gray-haired and retired, and she once again noticed that she was the youngest one there. The atmosphere was warm and cozy as a bunch of book lovers gathered to enjoy a new writer. Mercer admitted she was envious. If she could only finish a damn book, then she too could go on tour and draw admirers. Then she remembered her tour, short as it was. It made her appreciate stores like Bay Books and people like Bruce Cable, those rare booksellers who worked hard to maintain a following. He stepped to the podium, welcomed his customers, and began a glowing and generous introduction of Randy Zielinski. His years in the intelligence community had given him rare insights to the unseen dangers lurking around every corner, and so on. Zielinski looked more like a spy than a writer. Instead of the usual faded jeans and rumpled jacket, he wore a fine dark suit, white shirt, no tie, and had no trace of whiskers on a face that was tanned and handsome, and no wedding ring. He spoke off the cuff for 30 minutes and told frightening stories about future cyber wars and how the U.S. was at a great disadvantage in keeping up with their enemies, the Russians and Chinese. Mercer suspected she might hear the same stories over dinner. He appeared to be touring alone, and as Mercer drifted away, she decided that the guy had potential, though unfortunately he was in town for only one night. She also thought about the legend, the one in which Bruce hit on the younger female authors and Noelle did the same with the men. The writer's room in their tower was allegedly used for the sleepovers. Now that Mercer had met them, though, she found this hard to believe. The audience applauded when Zielinski finished, then formed a line in front of a table where his books were stacked. Mercer preferred not to buy one and had no desire to read it, but really had no choice. She remembered the frustration of sitting at a table and desperately hoping someone would buy a book. Plus, she was about to spend the next 3 hours with the author. She felt obliged and waited patiently as the line moved along. Myra saw her and struck up a conversation. They introduced themselves to Zielinski and watched him scribble his autograph in their copies. As they walked down the stairs, Myra mumbled almost too loudly, $30 down the drain. I'll never read a word of it." Mercer chuckled and said, "Same here, but we made our bookseller happy." At the front counter, Bruce whispered to them, "Noelle is at the house. Why don't you head on over?" Mercer, Myra, and Lee left the store and walked 4 blocks to the Marchbanks house. "Have you seen it already?" Myra asked. "No, but I've seen the book." "Well, you're in for a treat, and Noelle is the perfect hostess." The house was much like Noelle's store, filled with rustic country furniture and richly decorated. Noelle gave a quick tour of the downstairs, then hustled off to the kitchen to check on something in the oven. Myra, Lee, and Mercer took their drinks to the rear veranda and found a cooler spot under a wobbly fan. The night was sticky, and Noelle had let it be known that dinner would be indoors. Dinner took an unexpected twist when Bruce arrived alone. He said that their guest, Mr. Zielinski, suffered from migraines and was having a bout. Randy sent his apologies but needed to go lie down in a dark hotel room. As soon as Bruce fixed his drink and joined them, Myra went after Zelensky. "I'd like a refund of $30, please," she said, and it wasn't clear if she was joking. "I wouldn't read his book at gunpoint." "Careful," Bruce said. "If my little bookshop did refunds, you'd owe me a fortune." "So all sales are final?" Mercer asked. "Damn right they are." Myra said, "Well, if you're going to make us buy the books, please get us some decent authors in the store." Bruce smiled and looked at Mercer. "We have this conversation at least 3 times a year. Myra, the queen of trash, disapproves of almost all other commercial writers." "Not true," Myra fired back. "I just don't dig espionage and all that military crap. I won't touch the book and don't want it cluttering up my house. I'll sell it back to you for $20. "Now, Myra," Lee said, "you always say that you love the clutter." Noelle joined them on the veranda with a glass of wine. She was concerned about Zelensky and asked if they should call a doctor friend. Bruce said no. Zelensky was a tough guy who could take care of himself. "And I thought he was quite dull," Bruce added. "How's his book?" Mercer asked. "I skimmed a lot. Too much technical stuff. Too much of the writer showing off how much he knows about technology and gadgets and the dark web. I put it down several times." "Well, I'm damn sure not picking it up," Myra said with a laugh, "and to be honest, I was not looking forward to dinner." Lee leaned in and looked over at Mercer. "Dear, don't ever turn your back on this crowd." Noelle said, "Well, now that you're okay with dinner, let's eat." In a wide rear hallway, somewhere between the veranda and the kitchen, Noelle had decorated her table, a dark, round wooden piece that looked oddly contemporary. Everything else was old, from the mutton-bone chairs to the fine French flatware and large earthen plates. Again, it looked like something lifted straight from one of her books, a setting that was almost too pretty to disturb with a meal. As they took their places and refilled their glasses, Mercer said, "Noelle, I think I want to buy that writer's table." "Oh, it's yours. I had to put a sold sign on it because so many folks have been trying to buy it. It may take some time to get the money straight, but I must have it." "And you think that's going to cure your writer's block?" Myra asked. "An old table from France?" "Who said I had writer's block?" Mercer asked. "Well, what do you call it, then, when you can't think of anything to write? How about a drought?" "Bruce, you're the expert." Bruce was holding a large salad bowl as Lee took a serving. He said, "Block sounds too severe. I think I prefer drought. But who am I? Y'all are the wordsmiths." Myra laughed for no apparent reason and blurted, "Lee, remember the time we wrote 3 books in a month? We had this slimeball publisher who wouldn't pay us, and so our agent said we couldn't jump to another house because we owed the guy 3 books. So Lee and I came up with 3 of the worst plots ever, really ridiculous stuff, and I banged the typewriter 10 hours a day for 30 straight days. But we had a great one in the wings," Lee said, passing along the salad bowl. Myra said, "Right, right. We had the best idea ever for a semi-serious novel, but we were not about to give it to our jackass publisher. We had to get out of his lousy contract so we could snag a better house, one that would appreciate the genius behind our great idea. That part of it worked. 2 years later, the 3 awful books were still selling like crazy while the great novel flopped. Go figure." Mercer said, "I think I might want to paint it, though, the writer's table." We'll look at some colors, Noel said, and make it perfect for the cottage. Have you seen the cottage? Myra asked in mock surprise. We haven't seen the cottage. When do we see the cottage? Soon, Mercer said. I'll throw a dinner. Tell them the good news, Noel, Bruce said. What good news? Don't be coy. A few days ago, a rich couple from Texas bought Noel's entire inventory. The store is practically empty. Too bad they're not book collectors, Lee said. I saved the writer's table, Noel said to Mercer. And Noel is going to close for a month so she can hustle back to France and restock. Noel said, they're very nice people and very knowledgeable. I'm meeting them in Provence for more shopping. Now that sounds like fun, Mercer said. Why don't you go with me? Noel said. Might as well, Myra said. Can't do any more damage to your novel. Now, Myra, Lee said, have you been to Provence? Noel asked. No, but I've always wanted to see it. How long will you be there? Noel shrugged as if a schedule was not important. Maybe a month or so? She glanced at Bruce and something passed between them, as if the invitation to Mercer had not been discussed beforehand. Mercer caught it and said, I'd better save my money for the writer's table. Good call, Myra said. You'd better stay here and write, not that you need my advice. She doesn't, Lee said softly. They passed around a large serving bowl of shrimp risotto and a basket of bread, and after a few bites, Myra began looking for trouble. Here's what I think we should do, if I might say so, she said, chomping away with a mouthful of food. This is very unusual, and I've never done it before, which is all the more reason to do it now, you know? Venture into unknown territory. We should have a literary intervention right now around this table. Mercer, you've been here for what, a month or so? And haven't written a damned word that might one day be sold. And frankly, I'm getting kind of tired of your moaning and belly aching about not making any progress with the novel. So it's pretty obvious to all of us that you don't have a story, and since you haven't published in, what, 10 years? More like 5. Whatever. It's plain as day that you need some help. So what I propose is that we intervene as your new friends and help you find a story. Just look at all the talent around the table here. Surely we can steer you in the right direction. Mercer said, well, it can't get any worse. See what I mean? Myra said. So we're here to help. She gulped some beer from a bottle. Now, for purposes of this intervention, we need to set some parameters. First and most important is to decide whether you want to write literary fiction. Stuff you can't give away. Hell, Bruce can't even sell it. Or do you want to write something more popular? I've read your novel and your stories, and I'm not the least bit surprised they didn't sell. Forgive me, okay? This is, after all, an intervention, so we have to be brutally blunt, okay? Everybody okay with the bluntness thing? Go for it, Mercer said with a smile. The rest nodded. We're all having fun. Let's hear it. Myra crammed a fork stuffed with lettuce and kept talking. I mean, you're a beautiful writer, girl, and some of your sentences just stopped me cold, which, one could argue, is not something a good sentence is supposed to do. But anyway, you can write like hell, and I think you can write anything. So what's it going to be, literary fiction or popular fiction? Can't it be both? Bruce asked, thoroughly enjoying the conversation. For a handful of authors, right? Myra replied. But for the vast majority, the answer is no. She looked at Mercer and said, this is something we've been debating for about 10 years, since the first day we met. But anyway, Let's assume that you will probably not be able to write literary fiction that will slay the critics and also rack up impressive royalties. And by the way, there is no envy here. I don't write anymore, so my career is over. I'm not sure what Lee is doing these days, but she's damn sure not publishing anything. Now, Myra. So we can safely say her career is over too, and we don't care. We're old and we have plenty of money, so there's no competition. You're young and gifted, and you'll have a future if you can just figure out what to write. Thus, this intervention. We're just here to help. By the way, this risotto is delicious, Noelle. Am I supposed to respond? Mercer asked. No, it's an intervention. You're supposed to sit there and listen to us as we beat you up. Bruce, you go first. What should Mercer write? I would start by asking what you read. Everything by Randy Zielinski, Mercer said, and got a laugh. Poor guys laid up with a migraine and were trashing him over dinner, Myra said. God help us, Lee said quietly. Bruce asked, what are the last three novels you read? Mercer took a sip of wine and thought for a second. I loved The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna, and I believe it sold well. Bruce agreed. Indeed it did. It's out in paperback and still selling. Bruce said, I liked it, but you can't make a living writing books about the Holocaust. Besides, Mercer, what do you know about the Holocaust? I didn't say I want to write about it. She's written 20 books, all different. Not sure it qualifies as literary fiction, Myra said. Are you sure you would recognize it if you saw it? Lee asked with a grin. Was that a cheap shot, Lee? Yes. Bruce regained control with, anyway, the other two novels. A Spool of Blue Thread by Anne Tyler, one of my favorites, and La Rose by Louise Erdrich. All girls, Bruce said. Yes, I've rarely read books written by men. Interesting and smart, since about 70% of all novels are published by women. And all three sell, right? Noelle asked. Oh, yes, Bruce said. They write great books that sell well. Bingo, said Mercer. That's the plan. Bruce looked at Myra and said, well, there you have it, a successful intervention. Not so fast. What about murder mysteries? Myra asked. Not really, Mercer replied. My brain doesn't work like that. I'm not devious enough to drop off clues and pick them up later. Suspense? Thrillers? Not really. I can't do intricate plots. Spies? Espionage? I'm too much of a girl. Horror? Are you kidding? After dark, I'm afraid of my shadow. Romance? Don't know the subject matter. Porn? I'm still a virgin. Bruce added, porn doesn't sell anymore. You can get all you want for free online. Myra exhaled dramatically and said, those were the days. 20 years ago, Lee and I could make the pages sizzle. Science fiction? Fantasy? Never touch the stuff. Westerns? I'm afraid of horses. Political intrigue? I'm afraid of politicians. Well, that does it. Looks like you're destined to write historical fiction about screwed-up families. Now get to work. We expect some progress from this point on. I'll start first thing in the morning, Mercer said, and thanks. Don't mention it, Myra said, and since we're on the subject of interventions, has anyone seen Andy Adam? Reason I ask is that I bumped into his ex at the grocery store a few days ago, and she seemed to think he's not doing too well. Let's just say he's not sober these days, Bruce said. Anything we can do to help? Nothing I can think of. Right now, Andy is just a drunk, and until he decides to sober up, he'll be nothing more than a drunk. His publisher will probably turn down his latest, and that will mean more trouble. I'm worried about him. Mercer was watching Bruce's wine glass. Several times Elaine had said he drank too much, but Mercer had not seen this. At Myra and Lee's dinner party, and now again tonight, he sipped his wine, was slow to refill, and was in perfect control. With Andy out of the way, Myra led them through a recap of their other friends' lives. Bob Cobb was on a sailboat down around Aruba. Jay Acklerud was in Canada, spending some time isolated in a friend's cabin. Amy Slater was busy with the kids, one of whom was playing t-ball. Bruce grew noticeably quiet. He was careful to absorb the gossip but not repeat any of it. Noelle seemed excited to be leaving the Florida heat for a month. Provence was warm, too, but not as humid, she explained. After dinner, she again asked Mercer to join her there, maybe not for a month, for perhaps a week or so. Mercer thanked her but said she needed to work on the novel. That, plus money was tight and she was saving for the writer's table. "It's yours, dear," Noelle said. "I'm saving it for you." Myra and Lee left at 9 and walked home. Mercer helped Bruce and Noelle in the kitchen and managed to say goodbye before 10. When she left, Bruce was sipping coffee in the den, his nose stuck in a book. 2 days later, Mercer ventured downtown and had lunch at a small cafe with a shaded courtyard. Afterward, she strolled along Main Street and noticed that Noelle's shop was closed. A handwritten sign on the door explained that the owner was in France shopping for antiques. The writer's table was on full display in the front window in an otherwise empty room. She went next door, said hello to Bruce, and walked upstairs to the cafe, where she ordered a latte and took it outside to the balcony overhanging Third Street. As expected, he soon joined her. "What brings you downtown?" he asked. "Boredom, another unproductive day at the typewriter. I thought Myra had cured your writer's block. Wish it could be that simple. Do you have a few minutes to talk?" We have come to the end of the book hour, and today's reading of Camino Island by John Grisham. The preceding program was a production of Sight Into Sound Radio.